I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. You might be surprised to hear that even the Queen of England has taken up technology. President Obama gave her an iPod in 2009, and just last year, she asked for her own iPad. While she continues to send handwritten notes, the Queen has been known to send email to her grandchildren. But don't expect Queen Elizabeth to start tweeting, for she remains one of the most public and yet most private people in the world. Vanity Fair contributor Sally Bedell Smith is the first American author to have special access to Queen Elizabeth's inner circle. Today she talks with us about a woman who has sat on the throne since 1952 when she had turned just 25. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. When Queen Elizabeth walks into a room, even one filled with leaders from around the world, she is instantly number one, the most compelling head of state in the room. Queen Elizabeth II has stood in the spotlight since 1952 when she ascended to the throne at age 25. But while she remains one of the most famous women in the world, she remains one of the least well-known, both mysterious and well-grounded. Her reign has had her rubbing shoulders with the likes of Winston Churchill, Paul McCartney, John Kennedy, and the Obamas. In an era of unprecedented scrutiny, she has not only survived but flourished with impeccable grace. Best-selling author Sally Bedell Smith has written a new book about her, Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. Sally Bedell Smith has written biographies of Diana, the Kennedys, and the Clintons, and is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. She spoke in town last night at an event with Rainy Day Books, and she joins us right now. And Sally, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. It's
great
to be here.
Welcome to Kansas City. Well, at first glance, the Queen would appear inscrutable. Is she?
Well, certainly her public persona is inscrutable. That that image that everybody has of her, the stately walk, the regal bearing, the handbook on the handbag on the arm. But behind that, you know, I was able in this in my book to part the curtain and show what she's like privately. She loves to sing. She enjoys dancing Scottish reels at her estate in Balmoral. I have images of her when she was with her friends on and family on a Scottish cruise, sitting on a remote island on a box, belting out songs, or going to a friend's birthday party at the London Aquarium and blowing bubbles, or having entertaining friends privately, either even in the you know, beautiful dining room at private dining room at Windsor Castle, but also at picnics on her Balmoral estate, where she not only lays the table, she puts on her yellow rubber gloves and cleans up after everybody else. You know, she has a real joie de vivre. She's funny. She's a great mimic. She did a wicked Gordon Brown, according to people who have heard it, because she's very good at all those Scottish accents, having spent so much time up there. And she also has a great deal of humility, which was one of the most surprising traits that I discovered about her.
She slips very quietly into the back of movie theaters.
She does when the lights have gone down. I among the 200 or so people I interviewed was an elderly cousin of hers, first cousin, who has known her. Her cousins were some of the best sources for me because they've known her for her whole life. But this woman, who was then 92 and lives in a very modest house on the grounds of Windsor Castle that the Queen gave to her, and after our interview, I was walking out and I looked at a caricature that was done of those who had attended the cousin's 90th birthday party, and there was the cousin in the middle of the in the middle of the cartoon, and in the back there was the Queen in her glasses, kind of tucked away with all the other people, and it was some that trait, that humility, you know, which is so surprising for somebody in a situation in a role like that, was instilled really very early, in part by her mother. I remember being so struck when I was reading a letter that her mother had written to her when the then very young queen and Prince Philip, who were, by the way, the sort of Kate and William of their
time.
They were a beautiful couple, and they were on a world tour of 6 months and to rapturous, rapturous crowds everywhere, hundreds of thousands of people turning out to see them. And her mother wrote her a letter, and she said, "Isn't it good that you can be the vehicle through which the love of country is expressed?"
Well, she fell in love with Prince Philip at age 13 when she first met him, right?
She did indeed. Now, they are third cousins. They share the same great-great-grandparents, Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. And they had sort of crossed paths at various big family weddings and funerals and the like. But the first time they ever spent a day together was when she was 13 years old and he was 18, and he was a cadet, a naval cadet at the Dartmouth Naval College. And they came for the day, and according to the accounts of several people who knew her very well, including her then governess, Marion Crawford, but also one of her cousins, Margaret Rhodes, who I spent a lot of time with, who said she just fell in love with him on that day, and she never gave a second glance to anybody else. And he, of course, was a man of the world at age 18, so he had to wait for her to grow up.
And he was interested in her. Why, given the age difference?
Well, she was enchanting. She was, as a young princess, even though she was serious because she knew what her destiny was to be queen. But she was lovely to look at, and she had a personality that the people around her could see. And from her standpoint, he was part of the Greek royal family that had been kicked out very early when he was just a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd had a somewhat rootless life, was sent to boarding school at a very early age. His mother had a nervous breakdown when he was very young. His father basically left his mother. And he was attracted not only to her, but to being part of her family. King George VI and then Queen Elizabeth, later the Queen Mother, had a very tight, they called themselves We Four, and Elizabeth and her younger sister, Margaret. He would go to visit them at Windsor Castle and then up in Balmoral, and he wrote very touching letters about how he really appreciated being brought into their family.
But he was something of a Kate Middleton of his time in the sense that he wasn't seen, at least initially, as being of the right stock, in a sense.
Well, he was of the right stock. In a sense, he was even more royal than the queen, because her mother was from a very aristocratic family, the Strathmores of Scotland. And they had some, they could trace their origins back to some ancient kings. But Prince Philip was actually royal on both sides. The Greek royal family wasn't Greek at all, by the way. They were actually Danish, German. The Greeks had imported them in the 19th century to be their kings and queens. And so he had royal pedigree, but her mother really preferred for Elizabeth, or Lilibet, as she was known in the family, to marry into a family somewhat similar to her own. And the very kind of formidable aristocratic men who ran the royal household took a dim view of this European interloper. He didn't have any money, really. So he was part of the Mountbatten family, and there was a lot of suspicion of his uncle, Lord Louis Mountbatten, who had been the last Viceroy of India. Winston Churchill couldn't stand him, for example, because he thought he had presided over losing India. So the Mountbatten connection was somewhat suspect too, and they thought he was, as Mountbatten's daughter Patricia said to me, that they all thought he was a little pink, that he was too kind of too much of a modernizer, and therefore they thought that Philip would try and change things and move things faster than the royal household wanted. So there were a lot of factors at work there.
We're talking with author Sally Bedell Smith about Queen Elizabeth, her latest book. In terms of, Sally, degrees of difficulty when it came to trying to understand Queen Elizabeth, where does she rank compared with all the other big personalities you've profiled over the years?
Well, one stumbling block, I guess, but it proved not to be a problem in the end, is that in the course of her 60 years, she has never granted an interview. So that was, although I requested one,
never.
She's done a couple of voiceovers for documentaries where she's kind of offered some of her reflections. But as far as sitting down with a journalist, she has, or an author, she has not done that.
And she won't do it because, I mean, she's queen and...
I think it's just a policy that she established. It's part of, I think, establishing her mystique and or maintaining her mystique. And quite frankly, if she opened the door to one, where would it end?
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky in that I've spent a lot of time over there over the years. I am a pretty confirmed Anglophile. Over the past 30 years or so, I've been there frequently. I've made a lot of friends. When I previously wrote a book about Princess Diana, quite a few of them helped me. They knew Charles and Diana and were able to introduce me to people. And then when I came back when I embarked on my research for this book, I came to them and asked for their help, which they very kindly gave to me, and they in turn introduced me to more people. And most importantly, they served as my advocate in getting cooperation from Buckingham Palace, because that really was something that was enormously helpful to me.
I assume the Queen could have shut this down if she had
chosen to. She could have. And those who knew me and knew my work persuaded them that I would write a fair and serious book. And so the Queen was briefed, and I was given the green light, which gave me access to her inner circle of family and friends and advisors who had served her over the years, opened doors, and also allowed me to travel with her and to watch her in a whole variety of settings, all of which was very useful for understanding what goes into her job. She's not a figurehead at all. She has a whole range of duties, both public and private.
And her schedule, you point out, is calculated a year in advance,
yes,
and in more detail, 6 months in advance.
Yes.
That was just amazing to me. I mean, what a way to live a life.
Well, yes, it is very regimented. And in one of those reflections that she gave back in 1992, she said she worried a little bit about the next generation and whether they would be comfortable with that kind of regimentation.
Willing to do it, perhaps.
Willing to do it. But Charles certainly has been, as the heir to the throne, and William, although he's living a different kind of life right now, he's in the army, but he is assuming increasingly royal duties.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also found, again, by talking to her friends, that there is built within that regimented schedule of certain obligatory things she does in the course of the year, and she, at almost age 86, she carries out more than 400 engagements a year, traveling all around the UK and overseas twice a year. So she's busy a lot of the time, but she also has spontaneity. She spends a good deal of time off on her own with her family at her estates, to regenerate, as it will. She spends several months in the fall going up to Balmoral, her Scottish estate in the Highlands, and she spends about 6 weeks at Sandringham in Norfolk, where she is right now, and will return to London probably in a couple of weeks and begin all the Diamond Jubilee celebrations,
right,
that are really going to start in a couple of months.
You know, we live, Sally, in a highly cynical age. Just how beloved is she in England and, for that matter, around the world?
I would say I was struck by how beloved she is. For many years, people admired her and respected her. And there was an interesting moment that occurred in 2002 when, within a month and a half, she lost first her sister and then her mother. Her sister was several years younger than the queen. Her mother was 101. But these are the two people who were closest to her, and she soldiered on. She went through all of the things that she needed to do to celebrate her then Golden Jubilee. Mm-hmm. But there was a kind of a transfer that occurred. The queen mother was the queen mum. She was everybody's grandmother.
Right.
She was a sunny presence. She had a very different role from that of her daughter, who had so many more obligations. And there was an incredibly touching moment when the queen and Prince Philip left Westminster Hall, where her mother's body had been brought for the lying in state period. And they turned out of that whole square, Parliament Square, and there were crowds, huge crowds of people, hundreds of thousands of people who had turned out to watch the cortege taking the Queen Mother's body to Westminster Hall. And spontaneously, they all began to clap. They'd never done that before. And and she said it was one of the most moving moments of her life. And it was a moment when that love and affection, that love that they that the population had for the Queen Mother transferred over to her daughter, to the Queen. And they started taking kind of approval ratings or popularity polls back in 1969. And quite remarkably, the Queen has had about an 80% approval rating ever since, which any American president would die for. More than happy to have. And to the extent that there is a Republican movement in Britain of those who would like to abandon the monarchy and have an elected president, it's sort of gone underground and will remain so. And the affection for her extends around the world. Americans don't appreciate that one of her roles is as head of the Commonwealth of Nations, which is 54 countries. It's something like accounts for something like 3/4 of the world's population. And these are primarily former British colonies. They were formerly part of the British Empire.
Mm-hmm.
It started with the first nine countries that attained independence in the late 1940s. And it's one of her proudest roles. She spends a lot of time meeting with the heads of government from the Commonwealth countries.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever she goes to visit there, she gets an enormous reception, as she did last October when she went to Australia. Australia is one of those countries. It is where she is still queen. She's queen of 15 realms around the world.
Wow.
Australia. She's the queen of Australia. She's the queen of New Zealand. She's the queen of Canada and Jamaica and some smaller countries. And I suppose Australia has been the one place where Republican sentiment has been strongest.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been diminishing in recent years, in part because of Prince William, who's made two extremely successful visits there. But it certainly showed up in the way she was received last October.
Sally Bedell Smith is our guest this hour. Her latest book, Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. Your questions, always welcome here. 816-235-2888. Our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. Or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Well, you said, Sally, that you've never interviewed the Queen. No one has interviewed the Queen. But you have met her, and you've covered her on a few occasions.
Yes.
Tell us about meeting her once with your husband and how what happened there. It's a great story.
It was wonderful. It was actually before I decided to do the book about the Queen. It was when she was in the United States in 2007 for a state visit with the Bushes, and the British ambassador had a garden party at the ambassador's residence, and my husband and I were very patiently standing in a line. And
how do you get invited to something like that?
Oh,
and why am I never invited?
We were just lucky.
Yeah.
But in any case, there were 600-700 people there. The British ambassador, as he was going down the row, was picking out every sort of 12th person to be presented to the Queen, and he signaled to us. We knew him, and he signaled to us that he would be presenting us. And she extended her hand, and I shook it and said, "How do you do, Your Majesty? It's so nice to meet you." And she did the same for my husband and...
Who couldn't help himself.
Who couldn't help himself. You're not supposed to ask the queen a question, and you're certainly not supposed to ask the queen if she ever bets on the horses. She had been at the Kentucky Derby the previous weekend, and my husband, who knows quite a bit about horse racing, has watched it a lot. He knows how to read a race, and you know, we watch it on television, and he tells me things that I couldn't possibly see. So he said to her, did you put a wager on Street Sense? Which, you know, was like two protocol infractions simultaneously. But what was fascinating is she deflected it. She didn't answer it very adroitly. But there was something about the way he asked the question that signaled to her that he knew what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. And I then proceeded to watch the two of them replay the entire race. I mean, it probably only took them about – it was because it was dramatic. Street Sense was 19th, and he closed fast, mm-hmm. and he won. And she was just – she was so vivacious as she was talking about it. She said, yes, you could see his yellow cap as he was going along. And then at the end, he was all splattered with mud because this was very unusual for her. In Britain, when she goes to the races, it's on grass, so she's never seen anything like it. But what I spotted in that brief glimpse was this sort of exuberant side, you know, the big smile and the gestures and the flashing eyes that you don't see in public. Mm-hmm. So it kind of challenged my preconceptions about her and kind of fired up my imagination. So 9 months later, when I was asked to write a book about her, I didn't hesitate for a second. I thought, wow, there's something more there to be seen and to be learned about.
Well, a lot of people think they know something about her from the 2006 movie The Queen that of course, starred Helen Mirren. Do they know something about her as a result of that movie?
Well, I think the movie was very good for her in the sense that after all those years of Diana dominating everybody's thinking about the royal family, it sort of moved her back to the forefront. I talked to lots of people about the movie to see what their view was of its authenticity. I also talked to the screenwriter, Peter Morgan, and to Helen Mirren, who did an enormous amount of research. The movie was grounded in a lot of research, but Peter Morgan, who is a brilliant screenwriter, invented dialogue, invented scenes. What those who knew the Queen well pretty much agreed upon is that Helen Mirren uncannily captured aspects of her personality, things like her gestures, how she would put on her glasses, that wonderfully sturdy walk. It was a snapshot of the Queen's life, I would say, rather than a 360-degree view that you can get in a book. And it was also one of the most difficult weeks of her life. So the Queen that you saw in that movie was much more like the formal Queen that we all see rather than the private, jolly Queen. That there were little flashes of that at times in the movie. But so that was the big difference. But, you know, and for dramatic license, Peter Morgan, you know, created a kind of you know, he created a tension between Tony Blair and the Queen that was a bit exaggerated. They didn't talk as much, for example, during the course of that week. I have a lot in the book about that week because what wasn't given kind of enough credit in that movie was how responsive and how nimble and how creative, really, all of her advisors were working back in Buckingham Palace, coming up with this highly unusual funeral, very different from any other royal funeral that had ever been put on.
You know, details make books like this, and your book is just full of great details. Just a second ago, Sally, you mentioned her walk, and come to find out from the book that the walk, the very deliberate pace of her walk is very much intentional. Tell us about that.
It is intentional. One of her Lord Chamberlain, who is the top official in Buckingham Palace, told me that she walks slowly because she wants to absorb as much as she can, and she looks around and she takes it all in. And the stance is also something that's quite deliberate. And she once explained to the wife of one of her foreign secretaries the secret of her stance, and she was at the moment wearing an evening gown, which she pulled above her ankles. And she said, this is how you do it. You put your legs parallel like this, and you evenly distribute your weight, and that's how you do it.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, she has to walk this incredibly fine line.
Yes.
And again, you focus on that in here. What a trick that is to pull off, right?
It is a trick because on the one hand, if she is too much above everybody else, if she's too distant, if she's too remote,
she loses everybody.
If she's too inaccessible, she will lose the bond with her subjects. On the other hand, if she's too much like everybody else, she'll lose her mystique. And she's been able to carry off that balancing act
for almost 60 years.
For almost 60 years.
Wow, just amazing.
Or very soon, 60 years.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about Queen Elizabeth with Sally Bedell Smith. We'll talk about her dislike of seatbelts. We'll talk about her stalking of deer. And we're also talking about her longtime relationship with Diana. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation about new ALS research and shortages of anti-infective drugs, you'll find it in all of our older broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow, psychologist Wes Crenshaw joins us to debunk some myths about parenting teens with ADHD. This hour, we're talking with Sally Bedell Smith, the best-selling author, about her latest book, Elizabeth the Queen. Your phone calls welcome here, 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Sally, we were talking before the break about the 2006 movie The Queen, starring Helen Mirren. She didn't watch that film, did she?
No, she didn't.
Why not? How could you not?
Well, she's, as one of her close advisors said, she's the least self-absorbed person you'll ever meet. She's not particularly interested in talking about herself or seeing herself depicted. And she's also not particularly interested in hearing other people dwell about their problems. She's interested in other people, but that's just not part of her personality. She did not see it. In fact, Tony Blair came into one of his private audiences at Buckingham Palace shortly after the film was released, and the Queen said to him, "I understand there's a film. I'm not going to see it. Are you?" "No, ma'am," he said. And she hasn't. Although one of her close relatives who talked to me described having briefed her about it and said, you know, in the end, it was very favorable to you because it showed you as a grandmother most concerned with your two grandsons, Harry and William, and helping them get through the grieving process. But she said she really the cousin said to her, you know, it probably wouldn't be a good idea to see yourself depicted, particularly since that awful week in your life after Diana died.
Mm-hmm.
So she didn't. One of the people I talked to said that he had sent her a cartoon from a British newspaper that showed a movie theater, and in the middle of the movie theater, you saw somebody with a crown on her head, and it just said "The Queen" underneath it. And she was very amused by that, but she told him that she had not seen it, nor did she intend to. She was talking to one of her good friends, who's an American. She has quite a few good American friends, Monty Roberts, who is a California horse whisperer, and he said, "You know, ma'am, I've heard the movie is very good for the monarchy and very good for you." And she said, "Well, that depends on your point of view." And he said that he got the impression from her, she didn't say it explicitly, that she would rather he didn't see the movie because she wanted him to think of her as he knew her and not as Helen Mirren depicted her, because in a sense, the two have gotten conflated in a lot of people's minds.
That's always a trick with those films, isn't it?
Well,
there was another film that was very popular here, which, of course, was The King's Speech, the film about the tongue-tied king of England.
Her father.
She saw that film,
right? She did see that. She was reluctant at first to see it because for somewhat the same reason, that she didn't necessarily want to see her parents depicted. But after it got such an amazing reception. I know in this country and overseas, I talked to people in Britain, and it was the same reaction. At the end, a lot of people clapped because it was so inspiring. And, of course, when it won all those Academy Awards, she became more curious about it and did see it at a private screening. Later, she told one of her cousins, who recounted the conversation to me, that she liked it. She thought it was just fine. She wouldn't be the type to get over enthusiastic about it, but she did think it was a good movie.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to some calls. Sherry from Kansas City, Missouri. You're on with Sally Bedell Smith. Sherry, good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Actually, I have a question. Why does the Queen always have her handbag whenever you see her on television or in a reception?
And only does Sally know the answer to that question, Sherry, she can tell you what's in the handbag.
Go ahead,
Sally. Yeah.
Well, one of her ladies-in-waiting said that there's a very simple reason for her to carry the handbag. She's a very practical woman, and she wants certain things very close at hand. Her ladies-in-waiting carry certain things like needles and thread and safety pins and extra pairs of gloves, but her handbag contains things that wouldn't be too surprising to us, her makeup, a sweetener for her coffee. There's a little change purse, although I don't think it contains any change. A handkerchief, her reading glasses, some lozenges for her to have when she makes a speech. I talked to a man who sat next to her at a luncheon that I was attending, and he said he got a very good look inside the handbag, and he said to her it was like a lady's prop. I mean, she is very protective of it, and she likes to have it with her. And she wears, you know, she has all these things in her little evening bags, and then she has a very identifiable sort of boxy black or white or beige handbags that she carries with her. One unusual thing that she has been known to carry, and also described to me by somebody who witnessed this, is a bag hook. And this friend,
what's a bag hook?
This friend of mine watched her at a dinner party pick up her handbag as they were sitting down, and there was a suction cup, and she very discreetly spat into the suction cup.
No.
On the suction cup was a hook. And she took the suction cup and she stuck it underneath the dinner table and proceeded to hang her handbag on that rather than putting it on the floor.
The Queen of England. That's amazing.
The Queen of England
did
that.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the information.
Thank you, Sherry. And to what extent are those handbags fashion statements?
Well, her designers over the years have objected to them because they are pretty uniform. They're very expensive handbags. They're made by a company called Launer, Launer. But they used to sort of give her designers fits at the beginning because they wanted her to carry something a little more fashionable. Mm-hmm. But she was insistent, as she has been insistent really her entire career as queen, and having a very predictable, consistent look, mm-hmm. which has her hair, the kinds of dresses she wears. They're designed to be practical. She knows that they have a certain theatrical purpose.
And so, there's a certain comfort with her appearance, too, that she's always the queen.
She isn't going to surprise people.
Things don't change, and that's comforting, I think.
Yeah, and she needs to wear bright colors when she's outdoors. And I was astonished when I traveled with her to Bermuda and Trinidad, the degree of research that had gone into the kinds of dresses that she was going to wear at various occasions. They research national colors. They research colors that might be offensive to people. Wow. And indoors, she tends to wear neutral clothes because she's not that she doesn't need to be seen as at a distance. But she has little weights in the bottom of her skirts, and whenever she tries anything on, she makes sure that not too much of her leg is showing. Hmm. There are all kinds of things that go into the way she looks.
Well, in her nearly now 60 years as the queen, has there ever been a period, Sally, when she just said, I'm just tired of living in the fishbowl. I'm tired of this. I want to do something else with my life.
Never. It was her destiny. And
she knew that early on.
Accepted that. She was always in the line of succession. But at age 10, when her uncle King Edward VIII abdicated to marry the American divorcee Wallace Warfield Simpson. Her father became King George VI. Mm-hmm. She became the heiress presumptive, and she began to get a much more intensive education than she'd had before, mainly in British Constitution and history, including American history.
Mm-hmm.
She knew that it was her duty, and she also, in the coronation in June 1953, a little over a year after she took the throne, she made a solemn vow that she would serve her people till the end of her life. And whether that was, she had earlier said in a speech, whether her life was long or short, she would dedicate her life to the service of her subjects.
And more recently, she has said she's not going to abdicate, right? She's there.
She has. I spoke to George Carey, who is the Archbishop of Canterbury, during a particularly turbulent time when all the marriages of all her three of her four children were breaking up. And he went to her and said, I've decided that it's time for me to retire. She said to him, that's something I can never do. I'm going to carry on to the end. She said repeatedly, this is a job for life.
How is her health these days?
She's remarkably healthy.
At age 85 or 6,
she's
you said.
About to turn 86. She mm-hmm. she walks a lot. She still rides her horses. There was just
without a hard hat, right?
Without a hard hat. Yes, she has not worn a hard hat, and that's been the subject of criticism over the years. She always wears a scarf, and there was a joke that one of the members of the staff at Windsor yeah. Castle told me that the only thing that comes between the Queen and her heir is an Hermes scarf.
Mm-hmm.
She has a very practical reason for it that I discuss in
which
the book,
is?
Which is one of her horse trainers told me. He was out riding with her in Windsor Park and said, you know, ma'am, you of all people should set an example by wearing a hard hat. And she said, you don't understand. You don't have to get your hair done the way
yeah,
I do.
Right,
and that wasn't an expression of vanity. It was pure practicality because she knew that quite often after she'd been riding, she would have to go in and greet an ambassador or a head of state, and she couldn't afford to to have her hair all messed up before she went into a situation like that.
Sally Bedell Smith is our guest. We're talking about her latest book, Elizabeth the Queen. Again, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org. Well, she doesn't like hard hats when she rides horses. She also doesn't like seat belts.
No.
And she drives, one witness said, like a bat out of hell. She also refuses to wear, you know, this hard hat. The Queen's not a daredevil by any stretch, though, right?
No, she's not. She learned how to drive, by the way, in a very fascinating fashion, which was at the end of World War II, for about a month in 1945, she trained with the Auxiliary Territorial Service. She wore a uniform, and she learned to be a mechanic. She learned how to drive a 2-ton truck. She learned how to strip down an engine to change spark plugs,
wow.
to change tires. She drove this truck around London, and she takes great pride in her ability to drive. It's why she so often drives by herself when she's on her mm-hmm. private estates and those private roads. She mm-hmm. doesn't have a driver's license. She mm-hmm. doesn't have a passport, but she is allowed to drive on those private roads, and she likes to drive fast. I've found, and I have lots of English friends, they generally like to drive fast. I usually close my eyes when I'm driving with them.
Yeah. Did she ever reconsider seatbelt use after the death of Diana?
That's an interesting question. As far as I know, she hasn't.
Okay. Back to some calls here. Christopher from Kansas City, Missouri. Christopher, you're on with Sally Bedell Smith. Good morning.
Good morning. My question was about when the Obamas visited the Queen, and there was a photograph that a bunch was made out of
right.
because Michelle looked like hugging or touching the Queen. And what was behind that, and was it as big a deal as it was made out to be?
The answer is no, and Sally has a whole bunch of that incident in her book. Go ahead,
yes,
Sally.
I do. Yeah. Well, I had an eyewitness who was the Queen's videographer, wonderful man named Peter Wilkinson. I got to know, and he's always around with a video camera, and he often gives his video footage to the TV stations, which he did in this instance. But he was behind her, and he was watching. The Queen is not very tall, and Michelle Obama is quite tall. So
especially in heels.
And this
yeah.
was the circumstance was the G20 reception for the G20 leaders that the Queen hosted in Buckingham Palace. And she was standing next to Michelle Obama, and they were, in front of them were two of the Queen's ladies-in-waiting, and they were first sort of comparing their heights of their shoes, and then they were comparing their actual heights. And at that point, Michelle put her arm on the Queen's shoulder, and the Queen very quickly reciprocated because they were kind of demonstrating this. The Queen dropped her arm not too soon afterwards, and Michelle Obama kept hers on the shoulder. She actually gave her a little shoulder rub.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to the Queen's advisors, they said she was not the least bit upset by this. There have been many people over the years who have – I mean, they're not supposed to touch her. I think if, you know, if people started to touch her like that, you know, there'd be no end of it. But as a rule, when it has happened, she's been quite relaxed about it, as she was in that instance. She back in 1991, there's a really – quite amusing photograph that was taken of her when she was visiting Bush 41 on a state visit, and she went out to a housing project in Washington and visited a rather large, about 250-pound grandmother who had just built a house in a sort of public-private partnership, and they were very proud of it. And so the Queen walked into her house and Alice Fraser proceeded to give her this enormous bear hug. And there's just a great picture of the Queen sort of looking with her hands at her side, not quite knowing what to do. But again, she was very relaxed about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Christopher, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
So what was her relationship with Diana like?
At the outset, it was quite good. She welcomed Diana into the family. She said, you know, please call me mummy, call me mama, and made it. I talked to several of Diana's friends who said that she welcomed her, said her door was always open. Diana often went over to Buckingham Palace to go swimming, and she said, please come and see me if you'd like, if I'm not busy. But Diana was quite intimidated by her. Mm. She was very young, and the Queen can be formidable when you haven't had a chance to spend time and see how easy she can be.
Mm-hmm.
There was a pretty long period of time when the Queen didn't understand the extent to which the marriage of Charles and Diana was beginning to disintegrate. You know, they were pushed into a marriage way too soon. They didn't know each other very well. It turns out that they were a real misalliance. They didn't have the same interests. He was much older. They just
didn't click.
And after things really fell apart in 1992 with the publication of Andrew Morton's expose book that Diana had participated in, the Queen recognized that, she tried at first to see if she could arrange a rapprochement, but the Queen was very upset by that book, first of all because it was an act of disloyalty. Diana had secretly cooperated with it and then had not told the truth about it. But there was a lot of damaging information in there about Prince Charles, who was, in fact, the heir to the throne and her son. And that, I think, changed the whole equation in terms of Diana's relationship with the royal family. And it got even worse when she went on television 3 years later after the separation
and talked
in an even more damaging way. And it was at that point that the Queen sent letters to both Charles and Diana saying, I think it's time for divorce. That was a very painful thing for her to go through, not only with Charles and Diana, but with Princess Anne and her husband and Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson all at once. The year that all three of those marriages fell apart was 1992, and it was also the year in which Windsor Castle had a catastrophic fire, and that's when the Queen gave, a few days afterwards, her famous Annus Horribilis speech, which she talked about in very personal terms.
Mm-hmm.
This was supposed to be a celebratory year. It was the 40th anniversary of her reign, and it turned out to be one of the worst years of her life.
How did she react to Diana's fame? At the height of her fame, when she was such a worldwide celeb and everything she did was chronicled so closely, how did the Queen respond to all of that?
Well, it was something that was so alien to her.
Yeah.
She was not – she was the opposite of anybody who seeks fame. And she didn't understand them. She didn't – above all, the queen didn't want to be a celebrity by any means. And Diana was becoming a celebrity. It was something that concerned her, obviously. And the antics of Diana and Fergie got her down. She didn't say much about those kinds of feelings. She – one of her cousins, Patricia Mountbatten, said that once during all of that, all the bad publicity, she said, how did I get two daughters-in-law who misbehaved so much? I don't understand it. She didn't get Diana. She didn't – Diana had a lot of emotional problems that the queen couldn't really understand. There's a saying about members of the royal family that they tend to ostrich when there are things that are going badly. They have a tendency to avert their eyes, and I think she did that.
The queen got entangled, Sally, in a messy little matter with Diana's one-time butler, Paul Burrell. What happened there?
Well, it's a slightly complicated story. He was arrested for taking a lot of items that belonged to Diana.
Mm-hmm.
Furniture, dresses, you know, just a whole range of objects, and some things from Harry and William.
And the kids, right, yeah.
And from Charles. He went on trial, and there was another piece of the puzzle, which was right after Diana's death, he asked for an audience with the queen, and she very kindly...
Paul Burrell.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. Asked for an audience with the queen, and she very kindly gave it to him. She actually spent quite a bit of time with him because he was so close to Diana. Mm-hmm. He was so distraught. And in the course of that conversation, he mentioned that he was worried about documents, that Diana's mother had been coming to their apartment, her apartment in Buckingham Palace, and had been shredding documents. And he said that he had taken some things away with him for safekeeping. So the queen sort of filed that bit of information away and didn't really think twice about it.
Didn't object at the time.
Didn't object. And then subsequent to that, he was arrested for taking all these objects. The trial was scheduled, and it was already ongoing when Prince Philip was with Prince Charles one day, and he just happened to mention in passing that the queen had talked to Paul Burrell and had been told that there were a few of these papers that he had taken away. At that point, Charles alerted the authorities, who basically stopped the trial, because the whole notion of the prosecution of Burrell was based on...
It was a secret deal when, in fact, the queen herself knew.
The queen knew, and not only did she know, but it wasn't anything she suddenly remembered. I talked to somebody who was with her a couple of months earlier before the trial was scheduled to begin, and he said she was sitting there, as she is known to do during drinks, playing patience, and she was talking about this extraordinary time that she had met with Paul Burrell, mm-hmm. and he had confided in her that he had taken papers away, but she didn't think it was significant at the time.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as if they were, you know, she knew, and she talked about it with friends, and it was nothing secret to her. She just thought it was an entirely separate issue from this whole cache of objects that had been taken.
You know, Sally, her reign goes all the way back to the days when Dwight Eisenhower was president.
Yes.
And I'm wondering about her relationships with different American presidents. Am I right to recall that her closest set of relationships there was with Ronald Reagan and Nancy?
Yes, that's certainly the sense that I got. And it was one writing about her relationships, A, with her relationship with this country, and B, with the presidents, was something that other biographers really hadn't bothered with.
Mm-hmm.
And it started with Truman. The only one was Lyndon Johnson, who never got to meet her, desperately wanted to, but never made it. but she did have a particularly affectionate relationship with Ronald and Nancy Reagan, and Nancy Reagan was kind enough to share with me the private correspondence that they had with the royal family, and you could really see it in the letters. They were the first couple, American couple, to be presidential couple to be entertained at Windsor Castle back in 1982. In fact, to accommodate Ronald Reagan, the Queen built the very first shower in that medieval fortress.
Yeah.
And they spent 10 days going up and down the West Coast with them. And there was real affection. When the Queen's favorite horse died, Ronald Reagan wrote a long letter to her because that was the horse that she had ridden on the day at Windsor Castle when they took the famous ride together. And she wrote a very affectionate letter back.
Well, what a fascinating woman to have spent so much time with. Sally Bedell Smith, thanks so much for your time. I sure enjoyed
having
you.
Thank you, Steve. It was great to talk to you.
Again, that's Sally Bedell Smith. She's the author of Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. You'll find more information about our guests and previous broadcasts and podcasts at kcur.org. You can follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, psychologist Wes Crenshaw joins us again to debunk some myths about parenting teens with ADHD. Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Kim Noble, Danny Alexander, and Maria Carter. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.